Hello, and welcome to The Deduction, a podcast from the Tax Foundation. This is your guide to the complex world of tax and economics. My name is Daniel Bunn, and I'm Vice President of Global Projects here at the Tax Foundation, and I'll be your host for this episode. Today, we are joined by my colleague, Jared Walczak, to talk about state digital tax proposals. On the international side, I've seen all sorts of these digital tax proposals, but Jared is our Vice President of State Projects here at the Tax Foundation. And he has a new paper that looks at the various state proposals that have come up this year, as well as the serious questions that these types of proposals pose for tax policies. Welcome, Jared.
Great to be here, Daniel.
So I know we've been talking about the various digital taxes that have been popping up internationally. You've got France, you've got Austria, you've got Italy and Spain, and the U.S. wanting to threaten tariffs against those countries. But I'm really curious to talk about what's happening in the states, because I think it's a little bit different narrative, a little bit different structure to these policies. What are state lawmakers thinking about, and what's the future for these types of taxes? So let's go ahead and dive right in. Jared, what types of digital taxes are being proposed and passed in the states?
Well, there's really three different types that are being considered right now. One is a digital advertising tax. This is the type of tax that was adopted in Maryland earlier this year. It had actually been passed by the legislature last year, vetoed, and then the veto was overridden this year. That's a tax on the gross revenue from digital advertising in state. And you have a couple of variations on that model in different states, but several states are looking at that pure digital advertising tax. Then you have a slight variation on that, the social media tax. It's kind of the same thing. We're still talking about taxing digital advertising, but here it's limited to advertising on social media platforms. And in some of these proposals, you also see a per account fee, like a dollar per social media account associated with the state per year. And then finally, there's data taxes. And there's a couple of different ways that you can tax data. There's data taxes on essentially the possession of consumer data, where you're talking about a certain number of cents per month per individual in the state on which a company has data. Others that would look at perhaps a tax on the sale or the transaction involving consumer data, and others trying to assess it as if it's property, essentially intangible property, assessing the value of it and taxing it that way. So a lot of different ideas percolating out there, all of them pretty new. These are not things that states had been looking to tax until just a couple of years ago, but we already see it branching in several different directions.
That's super interesting. I think those various formats of taxing all create all kinds of potential problems and challenges and things like that. And we'll get to some of those later. But when I think about the digital taxes that I'm, aware of or in the rest of the world, there's a lot of motivation that's just pure politics about wanting to tax foreign tech companies and create a new theory of value for user contribution and taxing rights and things like that. But it sounds like the state narrative might be a bit different. What are the motivations behind these policy proposals?
You know, there's really not one single motivation or any unifying theme in these taxes. As you know, at the international level, there had been discussion about this lack of economic nexus and market sourcing to tackle these digital business models. And countries have looked at a couple of ways to address that. That's why we have these OECD Pillar 1 project issues. And that's complex, and I'll leave that to you. But international tax rules generally are relying on physical presence, the idea of permanent establishment rules. So it's common for a digital company to have customer bases, but not a taxable establishment in a country. That's really not how it works in the United States. Here, economic nexus or factor presence is how we apportion corporate income to states for tax purposes. So you have some states that I think started looking at this from an international perspective. Policymakers read about what was happening in Europe. They said, oh, is this a problem here? And they proceeded on the assumption that maybe there was some sort of loophole, that there was something not being taxed. And that's really not the case. Let's think just briefly, I think it's really important on this, about how you tax this activity, because of course we have corporate income taxes in most states. They are apportioned. And apportionment can go a number of different ways, but many states have single sales factor, meaning they exclusively tax based on apportionment based on the sales. Many of them that don't have single sales factor are still excessively weighting sales compared to the other factors. And the most common way to source service income is based on where the market is. So what you generally see, if a company is profiting by advertising in a particular state, then those profits are associated with that state and they're subject to the corporate income tax. And of course, the activity of the companies that are advertising, those are also going to be subject to that corporate income tax. So I think we started initially with some idea that there was a loophole, and that's just not the case. But there's a couple of other ideas that have been circulating as well. And again, I don't think they're justified, but you've seen a number of different ideas. You've seen the notion that, you know, there's a problem with targeted advertising. This was something that was put out in an op-ed a couple of years ago that got a lot of people's attention. It was by the economist Paul Romer. And he said, basically, targeting advertising is a really bad thing. We are going down a path we don't want. Let's tax it out of existence. But the state models aren't taxing anything out of existence. They are just taxing to generate revenue. We're not going to see the elimination of targeted online advertising. The states are just looking for revenue out of it. And then I think just generally, we've seen the idea of going after a particular industry. And sometimes that's split on ideological lines. I think some on the left have been pretty clear in the idea that the tech industry has money to spare, or that it's just an industry that deserves a second layer of tax. And on the right, increasingly, especially on the social media side, there's been a sort of punitive element as well. This idea that if maybe some on the right don't like the content moderation policies that social media platforms have put in place, that, well, maybe you can impose a second layer of taxation on them. And that's just bad tax policy. It's not a path that I think most people, left or right, want to go down, where we're deciding what taxes fall on an industry or a particular company based on their political profile or whether certain politicians like them.
Yeah, that fits a lot with what I've been talking about recently as far as actual policy proposals or just simple political motivations that happen to find a convenient policy. And I think that's what you're seeing a lot, especially as you mentioned, that, you know, current state sourcing rules mean that, and apportionment rules mean that some of these companies are being taxed on their profits associated with the data that's being used for targeted advertising in the state in which the targeted advertising is happening. It's a very different story, as you said, than what we're seeing in Europe and other countries around the world. So you're talking a good bit about the potential challenges here. And it seems like these policies are potentially really difficult to navigate, especially the ones that have already been adopted. What are the complexity and legal issues with these types of policies?
Well, Daniel, that's a lot. So let's start with what I see as the administrative nightmare associated with this, and set the legal issues to aside for one moment, because the administrative side is hard enough. If we are going to tax the advertising that is served into a state, the first thing, of course, we need to do is determine which advertising is served into a state. And that may seem easy enough, but the reality is it's not. It's, you know, not only are there, you know, proxy servers, corporate servers that may be accessing, may have IP addresses that are outside of states. IP tracing tends not to be perfect. You know, we can't perfectly geofence to determine is someone in state. And a lot of these proposals have some potentially competing elements. They say if the IP address to which the ad is served is in state, or if it's associated with an address in state. So, you know, what happens if you have an account on a website and you have an address in Maryland, but you're traveling into another state and your IP address is therefore in another state? Who taxes it?
It also sounds like there might be some, you know, kind of tracking that people might not want, as far as like figuring out where people are for these different taxes. I think that's another kind of privacy issue potentially, right?
It really is. And obviously, there's a lot of tracking that already goes on. But if initially the idea was, oh, no, there's all of this tracking, we're requiring more of it for administrative purposes for a tax. And there are further administrative challenges. You know, what if there's a blocking service involved? What if you ad block and the ad is not served? Is the tax imposed or not? We also have to define advertising. And again, one of these things you say, oh, I know it when I see it. But do you? Is voice over IP telephony a digital advertising service if it's used for marketing calls? Is a sponsored content sort of situation, you know, a sponsored newsletter, is that advertising? If you have it embedded in there, it's not a banner ad. How about streaming of terrestrial broadcasts? You know, we have a lot of radio and television that's now streamed online with ads that were perhaps placed for a terrestrial broadcast situation. How about email newsletters? In Maryland, they've gone back after the law was passed and tried to adjust some of this. So they said basically media companies are exempt. So we get rid of the terrestrial broadcast problem. We don't solve any of the rest. And then now we're just giving an advantage to one particular type. But these are administrative challenges. Being able to actually audit this in any meaningful way to know where these ads are served, that's extremely difficult. And we see even worse things with the data taxes. You have to know where, who the data is on. So you need information that sometimes is available, sometimes not. You don't always have addresses on every individual or account holder, and yet you need to be able to maintain that. If it's assessed on value, how do you value data that you may not be deploying right now? You may not be using in any meaningful way, but you have this information. And what's really interesting is, we think of all of the different data that's out there, but these bills are pretty simple. I mean, if you have addresses of your customers and you use that for anything other than billing them, that is data that you could be taxed on in the New York style proposal. If you have, maybe you're not even a digital company, just think about, say, a grocery store with a loyalty program. They obviously have a lot of information on their sales. That is data. Someone has to value that if you have a property tax style system. This is just all incredibly complex, and I don't think any state has figured it out yet.
It sounds like that grocery store loyalty program angle and the data valuation of that. It sounds like it's just a massive tax on marketing, period. And that, to me, sounds like a business input. It's a cost center. It's something that's generally a deductible cost, and your goal is to make profits off that marketing. So like you said earlier, this seems like a pretty unprincipled approach to tax policy.
It is. You're exactly right. We talk about the taxation of business input. When we think about taxes on consumption, those are supposed to be taxes on final sales, not on intermediate transactions, not on the business inputs. And this isn't because we want to give a preference towards businesses. It's because if you tax each of those intermediate stages, then whatever's finally sold to the consumer is going to have that same tax, or in this case, multiple different types of taxes embedded multiple times over. The company is being taxed on its profits. That's corporate income taxation. But now we're saying in these proposals, well, let's put additional taxes on having consumer data, or transferring consumer data, or advertising to consumers. So it raises marketing costs. It, of course, also raises costs for consumers and in-state businesses. And to me, that's a key part of this. A lot of it has been discussed as essentially we're going after the big Silicon Valley company. But of course, there's every reason to believe that a significant amount of the cost would be borne in-state. It's the restaurant that advertises on a search engine or a social media company. They're going to experience higher advertising costs because this tax is embedded in that. The consumers, in many cases, may experience higher costs, and it may change the availability of different products or how they're done. We look at the internet and we have free ad-supported services. We also, of course, have some services that are behind a paywall, and this may push more of it behind a paywall because ad-supported services are more costly, or there's a cost associated with maintaining the data of that user that needs to be defrayed in some case, or the same with a grocery store loyalty program. Obviously, the company is benefiting from the data. The customer is benefiting from deals. This interjects the government into there to make that a less attractive activity, which can be to the detriment not only of the company, but of course also from consumers. So there's a lot here just on the admin side and the compliance side before we ever get into the legal issues. And I think there are a lot of those.
Yeah, we'll get to those momentarily. But I think on the question of, who's going to bear the cost of these taxes, you highlight several that are pretty clear. Like you said, the restaurant that's advertising or that extra tax on the value of that grocery store loyalty program. In the taxes that I look at in Europe, some tech giants have just said, hey, we're just going to increase the cost of selling or advertising on our platform and directly passing on those costs to other businesses and kind of throwing sand in the gears and the whole thing. So let's turn now to the legal issues. So we know that Maryland has adopted this law, and there's all sorts of potential kind of legal issues. Why don't you just walk through those? This isn't my area of expertise, so I'll just hand it off to you.
Thanks. There are a variety of different issues, and the first and simplest one is a federal law called the Permanent Internet Tax Freedom Act. This legislation prohibits imposing discriminatory taxes on e-commerce. This is something that dates back to the very early days of the internet. Congress wanted to make sure that e-commerce wasn't at a disadvantage. That actually in some ways maybe sounds quaint now. I don't think we usually think of e-commerce as being disadvantaged compared to brick and mortar. But over the years, Congress amended this a couple of times. And what they landed on in the Permanent Internet Tax Freedom Act, as the name implies, it wasn't the original one, which was sunset. You cannot tax certain things. You can't tax internet access. You cannot tax data services. And you cannot impose discriminatory taxes on electronic commerce. So if you have the same tax and it applies to retail, brick and mortar, and online commerce, you're okay. If, however, you are targeting just what happens online, you have a problem. And the Maryland bill has an obvious problem here. And this same legal bar exists for other legislation around the country as well. They're trying to tax digital advertising, and they're not taxing all advertising in the same way. In fact, it'd be very difficult to tax all advertising. I mean, you can say, okay, we'll tax newspaper ads or something, but advertising comes in many different forms. And no state seems to want to try to figure out how to tax all of that with a special excise tax. And therefore, the goal has been digital. And the law just, in my mind, pretty clearly says you can't do that. There are those who have argued, I think, creatively, but not very compellingly, that no, it's not a tax on digital advertising. It's a tax on entering into contracts for digital advertising. I don't think the courts are going to look on that very kindly, especially since the tax is obviously imposed not on the number of contracts or on the cost of entering into that contract, but on, of course, the gross revenues from digital advertising. It's pretty clearly a tax on electronic commerce. It's discriminatory in that it's only taxing the digital and not all commerce. And then even beyond that, even if we didn't have that, we have a constitutional issue with the way that some of these bills have been written. The Maryland-style bills, and there are several of those. It's not just Maryland. There's one in New York. There's one in a few other states that have just basically copied and pasted the Maryland legislation, and they're considering these right now. They violate what's called the external consistency test. It's a test in a Supreme Court case called Complete Auto v. Brady. It's clarified in some subsequent cases like Jefferson Lines in, I think, 1995. Basically, what the Maryland bill is doing is it's taking all of the revenue, the global revenue, not just in-state digital advertising, and it's using that to set the tax rate. The idea being that your biggest players in Silicon Valley, the largest search engines, the largest social media companies, will face a higher tax rate on all of their in-state activity, all of their ads served into a state, than a smaller company would. And that's a problem because it clearly reaches beyond the portion of value that's fairly attributable to the economic activity in the state. You know, there are sales outside of a given state, Maryland or whatever state it may be. They're not relevant. And there are other issues as well. I mean, I mentioned external consistency. There's two sides to that coin. The other's internal consistency. So external consistency is basically the, does this make sense? Are you meaningfully trying to tax the activity in your state? Internal consistency says that if every state adopted the same rule, you wouldn't have double taxation. But the methodologies used here, or kind of the lack of one in determining whether advertising is in state, means that even adopting the same system could yield double taxation. And because so much of it really is left up not to the law, but to its administration, it can yield different results with the exact same language. There's a lack of specificity that just creates these due process violations. There are some leading scholars who say that these bills are just void for vagueness. You read them and you look and you realize legislators had no idea how they were going to define all these things. So they've just left it up to the state controller or the revenue director. And you just really can't do that. And then you get into data taxes, you get into some of those other areas, and you find even additional legal questions, again, taxing activity that has nothing to do with the state or discriminating against interstate commerce, which obviously you cannot do.
So that's a whole lot of issues, a lot of layers to the various legal arguments and potential challenges to these policies. But I want to hone in specifically on some litigation related to the Maryland law, because I know some of our listeners are probably interested in how things might pan out over the coming year with these various challenges, what the path forward is, what the various arguments are. Can you talk a little bit more about these litigation challenges to the Maryland law?
Absolutely. There's litigation proceeding on two different tracks simultaneously. One of them is in federal court and the other in state court. There are those who want an immediate federal court hearing. They feel that that is the better venue to bring the constitutional challenge in particular. There's always also those who feel that you're going to get just a more impartial hearing on whether a state has violated the U.S. Constitution or federal law in a federal court than a state court. So that's not always true. You know, we have a lot of, I think, very impartial judges in the states as well. But, you know, there's often desire to get both venues. The challenge with going the federal route is something called the Tax Injunction Act. At the federal level, if you're filing in federal court, the law usually needs to be in place. You can't enjoin a tax that has already been, that has not yet been implemented. And of course, this one has been delayed because of the litigation. Maryland actually hit pause, which creates a problem for the litigation. You know, they thought they were going to be suing against a law that was in place. Now they're suing about a law that will be in place. So the litigants there have an interesting argument to make that this is a tax for purposes of the Permanent Internet Tax Freedom Act, which I think is clearly the correct finding, but that it is not a tax for purposes of the Tax Injunction Act, which has a different definition of tax that doesn't include all taxes. That's nonetheless somewhat of a difficult needle to thread. It may be correct. We will see what the courts rule on the Tax Injunction Act, but it's possible that you won't be able to actually proceed on the merits in a federal case unless and until the law is already in effect and people are being taxed, which is why there's also an approach in Maryland courts looking at some similar questions, you know, raising the Permanent Internet Tax Freedom Act issue, raising some administrative and compliance issues that create ambiguity and uncertainty under Maryland law, and then looking at these constitutional challenges. So we'll see both of those proceed. It'll be interesting to see how they proceed in parallel. You always run into this challenge where sometimes courts really, you know, they don't believe these cases are ripe until someone has significant liability. And the counter argument to that is that you have to do tax planning around this. You need to be able to collect taxes or not. You need to be able to remit. So you know, the burden being established is sufficient. We'll see where that goes. Those questions are tough, but those are sort of the ancillary questions that get to when the case will be heard on the merits and when a decision will come down. The core arguments on the constitutionality and the legality under the Permanent Internet Tax Freedom Act, I think those are really strong arguments that the plaintiffs have. And clearly other states do as well, because we had a number of states that were looking very seriously at digital advertising taxes, and they've all pumped the brakes. There hasn't been any such bill that has thus far this year reported out of committee in any legislature. I think everyone's watching to see what happens in Maryland, because they've seen the administrative challenges that Maryland's struggling with right now, and they've seen the legal challenges, and they realize they're serious, they're very credible, and they're taking a wait-and-see approach.
Well, I'll leave it to Maryland, the state where I currently live, to try things out and be the guinea pig for everybody. Jared, you know, as we're, you know, kind of wrapping up this conversation, I think it's important for us to kind of, you know, put a bow on this and think about what policymakers should know about considering digital taxes. Not every state is going down this route. A lot of states are, but it's kind of a new issue. How should policymakers be thinking about this issue?
Yeah, above and beyond the legal and practical concerns that we've discussed, and there's more that we haven't been able to get into here, I think there's a fundamental question, and really it's a simple one. The question is why? Why tax this industry and this activity in particular, given that it's already subject to general taxes? What purpose is served? What cost is being offset? Which externality is being internalized? Policymakers need to ask themselves not only whether their proposal is practical or even whether it's legal, but also whether it is justified. And I think they want to think very carefully before using the tax code to target industries or specific businesses over objections to their policies or business practices. Policymakers should consider what they're trying to accomplish with the tax and whether it serves those purposes. And if it doesn't, they can think about the other ways they can do that. Again, as I mentioned, many states with their corporate income taxes already have market sourcing, and states are moving in that direction. If there's a state out there that says that, you know, the way that we do apportionment and the way we do sourcing, we're not capturing some of this. Well, there's a way to fix that. There's a way to fix that that doesn't involve creating a duplicative tax that discriminates against one particular industry or one activity and runs into all of these legal challenges. So, yeah, there's an opportunity to think about how tax codes work. There's always opportunities for reform, but I hope that policymakers will ask themselves whether there's really a justification for digital advertising, social media, and data taxes, or if these are just a flash in the pan, the big thing of today, that really have no place in our broader tax policy.
Well, that's a very, very good note to end on. I think it's always important to bring things back to principles. And I think one principle really at work here needs to be a principle of neutrality, not trying to discriminate against a particular industry or business model. But like you said, if there's need for reform, make sure it's done in a neutral fashion and makes sense from a general tax policy perspective. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Deduction. Thank you, Jared. This was a fascinating look at this area of state tax policy. You can find out more about Jared and his team's work at taxfoundation.org. You can also follow Jared on Twitter at Jared Walczak and get some of your data taxed that way, and depending on what state you might be in at the time that you're viewing his Twitter feed. If you want to follow the international side of taxes, I'm also on Twitter at Daniel D. Bunn. And thank you to everyone listening. We love to hear what you think about this podcast. So please let us know at taxfoundation.org/podcast. We'll have more dives into the world of tax policy coming soon. So make sure you're subscribed and you'll be able to catch another episode of The Deduction. You can follow everything from the Tax Foundation on Twitter at Tax Foundation, as well as LinkedIn. Thanks again, everyone.